This is Classic Business with Michael Avery on Classic 102.7 in Gauteng and Fine Music Radio in Cape Town.
Time for your view from the C-suite here on Classic Business in partnership with Altron, bringing you closer to the business leaders around the boardroom table, the CEOs, the founders, the CIOs, the chairs, and what makes them tick, what keeps them up at night, what gets them out of bed every morning. And in this instance, what lands them with the moon boot on their foot? This week's guest is driven to excel in not only a male-dominated world, but a world that has also in South Africa been largely dominated by white males. Bisani Maluleke, CEO of African Bank. Welcome, Bisani.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you have to share the story. You came in hobbling on crutches. I felt terrible. We should have done this interview telephonically. What happened?
I mean, firstly, I'm glad that I'm here because I get to see your delightful face. I was on a motorbike trip with my team, and I thought it was very important for me to show them what it would look like to dive off a motorbike and land gracefully. And clearly I didn't land as gracefully as I thought that I would do.
Now, that's taking leadership to the next level. How much longer do you have left in the boot?
About 4 more weeks. So I've survived 2 weeks, so I'm optimistic about the next 4.
And that survival instinct and resilience comes through in your story, Bisani. You were born in Soshanguve, north of Pretoria, very well-known area. You attended a local school there, only to become the first black female CEO of a commercial bank in South Africa. So to say the odds were stacked against you from the start might be the understatement of the year. Just tell me about your early years and what your dreams were as a child, because I see you actually studied law initially.
I did. So you can imagine growing up in a township in the 80s, one becomes very focused on human rights, the sense of, oh my gosh, you know, we clearly have a hard life. How do I make sure that I get my family out of this and that I stay out of this and get my community to a better place? So I became a lawyer predominantly because my father was a lawyer and I thought my father was the best thing since sliced bread. And also a lot of the people who were making a really big difference, I think, at that time were lawyers. So you'll remember that Mandela was a lawyer as well. And there were a bunch of people who surrounded my father who, you know, were part of his partners and were also lawyers. So I got into my head that people who changed the world are lawyers. And so it was that I went to varsity and I said to my dad, oh, I'm going to study law. And I thought he'd be excited. He said, no, you can't. Law is a jealous mistress, he said. Instead, you will study accounting. So we entered into a deal that I would study accounting, but if I hated it, then I would study law. And so I studied accounting. I did some auditing during VAC work, and I thought, this is going to kill me. So he agreed that I should not die as an accountant, but that I should rather try my hand at law. So I finished my accounting degree and studied law, and I loved studying law. It was just very romantic. You know, at the time, the Concord had just started and was putting out all these amazing judgments about, you know, things like access to socioeconomic rights and things like, you know, the right to life or death penalty cases, just beautiful judgments. It was amazing. And then I made the horrible mistake of thinking that going into a commercial law practice would be the same thing as doing con law. And it was not.
It's lots of contract work, lots of late nights.
Not at all romantic or sexy.
Not at all.
So and I didn't love law, but then I went into corporate finance and that's how I got into banking.
And this week we saw the retirement of Justice Edward Cameron, who is certainly one of the pioneers in that area of constitutional law as well. What persuaded you then? So you practiced law for a while, you realized that this isn't for you. What persuaded you to go and study an MBA and why Kellogg in particular?
So at that stage, I'd been at RMB for about 4 years, I think. And I realized that a lot of the people who were interviewing to come into RMB had international experience, which I did not have. But this also was 2008, so the financial crisis had started to play out and it was becoming very difficult to get jobs overseas. But people said, well, if you can't get a job overseas, go do an MBA. So I thought, this sounds fantastic. So I did a bit of research about schools in the US and I visited a few business schools in the US. So I went to Columbia, went to Harvard, and I went to Kellogg. I must tell you, you know, when I walked into Kellogg, it just felt like home. You know, it felt like the students owned the school. Mm. Like at Harvard, I felt like, oh my gosh, everybody feels so grateful to be on hallowed ground, right? Kind of walking on eggshells. Whereas at Kellogg, I felt like the students really felt like this is home and they treated it like it was home. And I loved the sense of community that Kellogg has. And I think that's what Kellogg is also famous for.
And within that community, those connections, those contacts that you made back then, many of them still with you today?
No, I can't say that. One of my professors said, you're lucky to walk out with 4 really strong connections coming out of Kellogg. And I think that's absolutely true. I think the people that I have retained as part of my network, they keep bringing me joy, I guess, and helping me to reach for higher levels of success.
Must have been an interesting time with the global financial crisis unfolding and questions around the banking sector in particular. We see a bit of a rolling back of the Volcker rule this week, which was in response to that. So it must have made for some fierce academic debates.
Absolutely. You know, it was fascinating. We debate about what actually happened, right? Then you kind of think you all agree on what happened. Then you're like, okay, well, so how are we going to prevent this? And I just remember leaving business school still feeling like we still don't have a clear idea. We don't have certainty that this won't happen again, you know, that the people who are responsible for this are not feeling like they are responsible for it. And you still get that sense, right?
And once again, we have global debt in non-financial corporates at record levels. We have central banks that have even less in their policy armory to respond if there is another debt-triggered financial crisis.
That's also true.
How much have we learned?
That's exactly the point. You know, and maybe the lesson is that, you know, when there are strong vested interests, as there are, that have been developing over just generations, it's very hard to uproot that stuff. You know, when people feel a sense of entitlement and they feel a sense of rightness, you know, it's really difficult to change that.
You could quite easily be talking about some of the status quo in the South African economy as
well.
I was chatting to a gentleman on the show last night about access to networks to help young black entrepreneurs. And those networks that in white society you take for granted are certainly not as developed in black communities. And so therefore there has to be some kind of systemic or structural intervention. Now, on your return, you then headed First National Bank's private clients business. This is 2012 now. Yeah. You didn't stay there for very long though. Did you just not feel that private clients was the space for you?
There were many different factors that just made it a rather an environment that I just didn't enjoy and one where I didn't think I would grow. I mean, F&B is a great business. This isn't about saying that it isn't. It just wasn't the place for me.
And then you left the bank and joined a corporate finance firm before then joining African Bank as an independent director back in 2015. What drew you into the African Bank story? Because that was around the time of Leon Kokkinis and everything sort of unfolding and blowing up around the bank, it seemed.
You know, it goes back to your point a little while ago about networks and people. I joined because the chairman at the time phoned me and said, you know, I think you must do this. And after speaking to him for about an hour and a half about why he was doing it and why he thought I should do it, I mean, his story was compelling and he himself is a very compelling man. So Louis van Zander said to me, look, Basani, African Bank has been the bank that has served black people and black communities for, I suppose, since 1975. That it is the mainstay. It is something that was founded by, in many ways, the godfathers of black entrepreneurship in South Africa. And he felt it was important that we save the organization, that we do our part to making sure that this institution survives. One, that it survives, and two, that it thrives, right? Because if it's a business that's designed to serve people who are the most marginalized in our society, then we deserve to make sure that those people don't become more marginalized. I mean, how can you say no to a story like that?
No, that is full of mission, especially for someone such as yourself. If you look at the bank now, obviously you've been busy overhauling the strategy, the structure of the bank. We still have the Reserve Bank and some of the country's largest banks who stepped in with an equity injection involved. They obviously want to pull out now, and that's going to be a phased process.
Right.
The reports and the Myberg report in particular did point to glaring issues around due diligence and the Ellerines transaction, but fundamentally, the business model didn't work. How have you changed the business model to be more fit for purpose?
So the first thing we had to do was to change the risk appetite, the credit risk appetite. What that practically means is that we tightened our lending criteria, which means that we can't lend to a lot of the people that we used to be able to lend to. And by so doing, we've actually seen that the quality of the credit that we write has been improving over time. So we're very proud of the fact that, you know, we are seeing this constant improvement in the quality of our credit. And then the second thing that we had to do was to start to fund the book, not only from wholesale funding, but also from retail deposits. So we're very proud of the fact that our retail deposit book that is getting, you know, deposits from ordinary people in the street. I mean, that has been growing at almost 100% every 6 months. So it's an amazing, amazing story for us. And yes, it's off a very low base.
Off a low base, but also because you provide probably the most attractive interest in the country.
And that's definitely part of our strategy to make sure that we offer the highest interest across all the products that we offer in that savings and investment space. So we definitely offer the best value.
And it's previously at rates that were considered for high net worth clients. You've got to have 100,000 or more before you can even access those kinds of rates. And you really democratize them.
Absolutely. That's exactly what we're trying to do. We were trying to say, imagine if you could get the same benefit when you have 500 Rand versus when you have 100,000 Rand. And we're seeing that, right? And we're adding a lot of value to people. And we're also making it easy, right? So a big part of our strategy is to make sure that we digitize more. So we've been building our digital platform over the last, I suppose, since coming out of creatorship. So since over the last 3 years. And we're proud of the fact that now people can open an account fully online and make their deposits. They can go into a branch if they want to. They can do it through the contact center. And we're all about creating greater levels of convenience. The other thing that we're very excited about is the launch of our transactional banking account, which we launched publicly in May of this year. So it's been going for only a few months now. And there we are seeing some really great take up with people starting now to direct their salaries into those accounts.
And is that the My World account product?
The My World account, yes.
And that comes with all kinds of innovations. There are things like pockets and the power pockets. You've got a savings pocket. And it is about innovation in a space that is very competitive at the moment. But there's also this broader conversation that we're having in South Africa with the Credit Amendment Act having ruffled some feathers. We saw Capitec, which really grew into becoming South Africa's biggest bank by customer numbers through focusing on those traditionally excluded by commercial lenders. They've said they're actively reducing their exposure to low-income earners as a result of this. There is concern about the unintended consequences here of writing off debt. How is that going to impact you? How much of your book is in that particular market?
So about 6% of our book is in that market. So it's not huge. And that's because, as I mentioned to you earlier, we have been gradually tightening our lending criteria since coming out of creatorship. And in fact, we've been tightening on numerous occasions since coming out of creatorship. And as a result, that end of the market has been becoming a smaller and smaller proportion of our book. Look, I think that the bill or the act that's now been passed is devastating for low-income earners. I think people who are now no longer going to be able to go to the formal sector for credit are going to end up going somewhere else and paying a lot more for that credit. I also think what's worrying for us is that people who have been paying consistently and managing their credit risk reasonably well. So what I mean by that is people who have reasonably healthy credit scores might see this as an easy way to start paying for their credit. And by so doing, their credit scores will deteriorate, which means they'll become a higher risk from a lending perspective. So I think the unintended consequences of this are tremendous, and I think it's unfortunate that the Act was passed in its current form.
It really is. When we talk about financial inclusion, this is not going to go into the positive side of the ledger in terms of improving financial inclusion. In fact, to your point, it certainly looks like it'll exclude more than it includes. We don't want to see more people in the hands of machinistas. I think a lot of what we, you know, we're a couple of weeks out from the Marikana tragedy and the anniversary of that, and a lot of that was on the back of machinistas. Mine workers who were heavily indebted and certainly saw no way out of it because of that exclusion. How can we be more inclusive as a financial services industry while also managing the risks, while also managing those issues that you spoke to earlier?
You know, I think we must all do our part. So consumers also need to be much more careful about how they manage their own cash flow. And I say that knowing that, you know, low-income earners don't have the same luxury to manage cash flow as high-income earners. But that notwithstanding, they still are responsible for making sure that they manage their own cash flow. And I think banks can always do a lot better around how they lend. What are their lending criteria? How do they think about affordability? At which point do you not lend to somebody? Things like, you know, how many loans do you give to a single person? You know, being stricter and being much more deliberate about making sure that we help our consumers to make smarter decisions about their lending. One thing that we're very excited about as African Bank is that we've started a process now of giving people access to these credit scores and to their credit reports from the bureaus. And our intention around that is to start helping consumers to understand what those credit scores actually mean and to actually be deliberate about managing them. So we're going to be giving them information about, you know, how to make sure that they improve those scores over a period of time and how to make sure that they monitor them more responsibly.
Yeah, inculcate that sense of ownership and engender that sense of responsibility. And I think it is about information, empowering those consumers with the right information. And obviously financial education for me is a big one. Working as a financial journalist, you realize how often we'll sit across the table and we'll talk jargon to most people, but it feels like everyday English. And we really need to do a lot more in the financial education space. Bassani, where we need to do more as well, and while you've been able to summit the banking sector, all the studies show that there's still a long way for South Africa in growing women into leaders. There are precious few CEOs in leadership positions in the country. How do we get there? What would you like to see businesses do and society do to encourage more women business leaders?
You know, I think we must all own the problem. I was looking at a tweet the other day of Parliament, probably in Sweden or one of the Scandinavian countries, and the chairman in Parliament, well, with the chief whip or whoever, whatever the right title is nursing somebody's baby. And the caption is that one of the parliamentarians had brought a baby into work and the chairman was helping to nurse the baby while the parliamentarian was doing their job. And I thought to myself, we need to figure out how to own child rearing as, you know, both men and women, because there's just no other way around it. I think often women end up having this need to look after their children, which takes away from the time that they have to grow their careers. I think for me, what worked is the fact that I had a lot of men who were my champions, right? Who made a conscious decision to help me to progress my career. I think we all need that. We all need people who be on our side to help us to be successful.
And I believe, speaking of successful, you're also a big lover of tennis and a big fan of Serena Williams.
Of course.
Do you bring any of that into your leadership, your love of sports? And you're clearly quite active when you can be hopping on motorbikes. Is that your leadership style?
I must tell you, I'm not a sports fan by any stretch of the imagination. I love Serena and I love tennis, but when she's not playing, I don't watch. No, I suppose what I love about Serena is she's resilient. Now she's unstoppable when she's at her best and she's always striving to be her best. And I feel like those are really good qualities and we can all learn something from that.
And talk about, you know, what she's done for inspiring other women, having That's a child, true. Coming back and being number one and winning Wimbledon again. I mean, it's just such an amazing story.
Yeah. And at the same time, you know, being very deliberate about fighting for the rights of women, for equal pay, for better healthcare for women. I mean, she's an unstoppable force in everything that she tries to do. And I really think we can all emulate that.
Well, Vasani, I hope you will continue to be an unstoppable force and wish you a speedy recovery from your recent biking injury. Thanks for sharing Michael. Your insights in this week's View from the C-Suite.
Thank you so much. I've enjoyed our chat.
That was Vasani Maluleke, CEO of African Bank, sharing her view from the C-Suite, which is brought to you, as always, by Altron, technology partners in your digital transformation journey. For more information, visit them at altron.com. Altron, there when it matters.